by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stanzel, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Wakona Park in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, is America's oldest minor league ballpark. Now, the park has seen better days, but the people there at Pittsfield apparently loved the park and wanted to see it preserved. Former New York Yankee pitcher Jim Boughton came up with a way to do that and put a ball club there that would stay there. And a lot of people in the community of Pittsfield liked that idea. The problem was the people that didn't like it happened to be the town's power brokers, the mayor and the city council and the bank and the newspaper. What they wanted to do was build a brand new $18 million stadium there. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jim Boughton about his struggle to save the old ballpark. He has written about this in his book, Foul Ball. The subtitle tells it all, My Life in Hard Times Trying to Save an Old Ballpark. It's published by Bulldog Publishing, and in fact, he published the book himself, and we'll get into that story about how it is he happened to publish this book himself. He's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana. He will be giving a talk about the book tomorrow, 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Plym Auditorium in Temple Buell Hall, and then right afterwards, there will be a book signing managed by the Illini Union Bookstore. There also will be a signing at Borders Bookstore. That's at 7 o'clock. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you would have a couple of opportunities to meet Jim Boughton and pick up a copy of his book. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him. In 63, he was an all-star pitcher, and he won 21 games for the New York Yankees. In 1964, he won 18 games, and he beat the Cardinals twice in the World Series. He's probably best known for his diary of the 1969 season with the Seattle Pilots and Houston Astros, a book titled Ball 4, which was a bestseller and is generally regarded as being the first tell-all sports memoir. After that, he became a television sportscaster. He acted in a movie. He made a brief comeback with the Braves and continues now to do a lot of public speaking and traveling around the country. By the way, if you've never read Ball 4, you might want to take a look at a brand new edition, kind of a 30-year edition. It's titled Ball 4, The Final Pitch, with a new epilogue that he has also published. A Bulldog is the publisher on that. As we talk this morning, questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Mr. Boughton, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Nice to be here.
Tell us about the park, about Wakona Park.
Well, it's one of the last of the wooden ballparks. It's rated by people who rank ballpark experiences. It's called a great baseball cathedral, a step back in time. It's always ranked in the top 5 or 10 stadiums in the country in terms of that old time baseball experience.
And what kind of community is Pittsfield?
Pittsfield is it was a blue collar town. It used to be the home of General Electric, but when the city abandoned the town years ago, They've had to adjust to changing over from a blue-collar, sort of a working-class town to a more of a service-oriented community and tourism. So it's been a bit of a struggle for the community. They're eclipsed north and south of the city by the Williamstown Theater Festival, and down south you have Tanglewood. So there are cultural things all around Pittsfield, and Pittsfield's claim to fame was its ballpark, and its baseball team. And of course, when the local team owner moved to another city because they built him a new stadium there, Pittsfield was going to be without a team. And that's when this new stadium reared its ugly head again, even though the people have voted against it. They couldn't seem to get rid of the idea of the threat of this stadium being built.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you pointed a trend here, and it's something I know that you have talked a lot about, and that is the, I guess there's maybe no other word for it, blackmail, I think, is a pretty good one, that various places around the country, teams have said, if no matter what kind of facility they have, but particularly, I guess, if it's an older one, they say to the local government and the people in the community, say, well, you know, if you want the club to stay here, you're going to have to build us a new stadium. And that's worked at a lot of places. They have actually done that and spent millions, literally millions and millions of dollars to keep teams there. And it seems to be a threat that few teams are above exercising to get themselves new stadiums.
Yeah, and not just millions, but an estimated $16 billion has gone to build new sports arenas over the last 20 years at the expense of schools, hospitals, and fire departments. In baseball alone, just at the minor league level, no fewer than 113 new minor league baseball stadiums have been built. And most of them in towns that had perfectly good older ballparks but didn't have some of the corporate suites and some of the amenities that now even the minor league ballparks are insisting on. And the team owner has just simply moved the team. And fans, you know, they have this baseball legacy of, as they've had in Pittsfield, going all the way back to the early 1900s, and they hate to lose that. And what is their choice? And that's why our plan to resurrect the old ballpark and put in a fan-owned team was such a sort of a revolutionary. Even though, but we never got our wish because we were opposed by a small group of powerful people. Most of them, mostly led by the Berkshire Eagle, the only daily newspaper in town. And the stadium, the new proposed new stadium, was going to be built on land coincidentally owned by the newspaper.
You think that there'd just be a little bit of conflict of interest there on the part of the paper in the way they covered this story. Was it commonly known that, in fact, that the land that was being considered as the location for the stadium belonged to the paper?
Oh, yes. The paper was, they were upfront about that. What they weren't upfront about was the fact that the property was polluted. They never told the people that. And something that's come out more recently, they never told the people that their, quote, donation of the property, what they were calling it as a donation of polluted property, their donation was a contingent upon them getting naming rights to the new stadium. And they never revealed that they were going to get naming rights. Well, the naming rights are worth far more than the value of the property. So the paper was not... Was not very responsible in terms of full disclosure.
So when there had been a team there that apparently had been lured out of town to another community where they said they would build them a stadium, so when did that happen? When did the existing team leave?
The existing team left in 2002. That was their first season not playing in Pittsfield. But by that time, the new stadium had been defeated. And also, our plan to resurrect the old ballpark had also been voted down unanimously by the Parks Commission. And instead, they gave the old ballpark to a competitor of ours, a guy who's been shopping around for a new stadium, one of these team owners looking for a place to play. And the reason they gave it to him was because he's a new stadium guy, and he would have been the perfect guy to block us out, because our plan would have put a stake in the heart of a new stadium, but by putting a new stadium guy in the ballpark, they kept that hope alive.
Yeah. So it's apparently that for some time there, then the city government had this idea that they wanted to try to keep the existing team there, and they figured, well, the way to do that would be to outbid whoever said, well, you come over to my community and I'll build you a stadium. The problem was there that there were several referenda trying to get people there in the community of Pittsfield to approve building this new park, this $18 million park, and tried three times and three times the people said no, they didn't
want
it.
That's right. Yeah, they didn't want the new ballpark, and they voted against it, even though they were threatened by with losing baseball altogether if they didn't vote for it. They still didn't vote for it. But anyway, the problem wouldn't go away because the people in town, the powerful people, were calling the shots. And this is a common thing in most communities. The people, the citizens, don't really want these new stadiums, but the politicians, conspire against their own electorate, and mostly they get their way.
Well, they, I'm sure, make the argument that building a stadium like this is good economic development policy.
Yes, that's the common argument, but almost every independent economic study that's ever been done shows that these new stadiums and sports arenas are not economic engines of development, because first of all, they don't provide very many jobs, and the jobs they do provide are very low paid, you know, ticket taker, groundskeeper, popcorn vendor, that kind of thing. The real jobs that pay are the players, and of course they take their money home with them when the season's over. And in terms of economic activity springing up around the stadium, well, yes, you have some of that. Bars and restaurants start doing better around the new stadium, but that really just cannibalizes people going to bars and restaurants in other parts of the city. So you don't have more people going out, you just simply have them going out to different restaurants and bars. So, and then generally the tax abatements that go along with it, and the land swaps and, you know, all that other stuff. The financing of these new stadiums is always complicated. And the reason for that is that the people behind the new stadiums have to play a game called hide the subsidy, so that the taxpayers can't really see how much they're paying for these stadiums.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Jim Boughton is former baseball player. He played for the New York Yankees, pitched for the Yankees, wrote a book that came out about 30 years ago that got a lot of attention, titled Ball Four. I don't know what my problem is. The new book, which is about the story here we're talking about, his efforts to try to save this ballpark in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. That one is called Foul Ball, and they're both, he's published them himself. They're both published by Bulldog, and they are available in bookstores. He's going to be here on the campus tomorrow in the afternoon to talk about this story. It's sponsored by Urban Planning, Architecture, Landscape Architecture, Leisure Studies. I think you may be the first former ball player, I think, to talk there in the architectural gallery. He'll be talking about that. And then there will be a book signing, one right after the talk and also in the evening at Borders. So if you'd like to meet him and pick up a copy of the book, you can do that. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So apparently what you did was you were interested, like a lot of people, in seeing the stadium preserved. And you came along and said, well, look, what we can do is we can fix up the stadium so we'll preserve it. We can get a team to come in here and play. And you also came up with this idea that you would sell, essentially sell shares in the team to local people in the community and make it less likely that that team would ever leave.
Yeah, it was our idea was that the community would own the team, and therefore they would never leave town because it would be owned by all local people. And this is also a practice, incidentally, that is banned now by major league sports, because they don't want teams being owned by the public. Because if they are owned by the public, then they don't have as much the league doesn't have much control over the team, and also they can't be part of the system of teams bidding one community off against another. So you're not going to see any more Green Bay Packers, which is probably, I think, the only community-owned major professional sports team.
As you have sketched it out, it seemed that the power brokers in the community just didn't like somebody else, an outsider coming in, making a proposal. The newspaper, they owned the land that was the place that they were talking about putting the stadium, so they certainly had some interest there. But as people, when the mayor and the parks commissioner and those kinds of people, when they told you why it was they thought your proposal was a bad idea, I mean, what sort of justification did they give for saying, no, we don't want to do that, instead what we want to do is build this new $18 million stadium?
Interestingly enough, they never really had to make that argument, because they refused to engage in any kind of a debate with us or any kind of public discussion. They didn't want to have that discussion because they really had nothing to say about why their proposal was better than ours. So there was sort of it was almost like living in a parallel universe. Here was the Berkshire Eagle, the newspaper, promoting the new stadium and attacking us without ever really matching the two offers up against each other and explaining why one was better than the other. And we never ever got that opportunity. Nobody ever was willing to, come to a public meeting. We set up several opportunities for our opponents to meet us face to face on a stage, in front of people, take a telephone poll, that kind of thing. They didn't want any part of us. The newspaper continued to print misinformation about us and our proposal, and it became a full-time job. My partner and I spent all of our time doing this, and the reason we did it was because we were shocked at the response we were getting as, two businessmen coming in offering to do something good for the community and not getting a fair hearing. And so we took that as a challenge, and we did not go away, as most businessmen in the past have gone away. We stayed in there every day, and it became a 24-hour job, week after week, month after month. And as my partner and I said, we were plumbing the depths of their unreasonableness. We wanted to expose this lack of democracy in this this newspaper here, which my partner said was like living in Russia and having Pravda against you. It really it became part of the fun of the adventure. Of course, it wasn't that much fun for our wives. I remember saying to my wife, Paula, one time, I said, who else but Chip and I could do such a thing like this? And she said, single people mostly.
Well, it's a tribute to the strength of your relationship that you're all still together, right?
Yes, it is. It really showed the level of media malfeasance, and I believe that was the reason why I've been asked to speak at media reform conferences and that kind of thing, because foul ball really shows the dangers of when a distant media conglomerate owns the only daily newspaper in town. So it's more than a story about political corruption. It's also about media concentration, which I think is probably the most important story we're facing in this country right now.
Well, let's talk with some people who are listening. We have a caller here in Champaign. We would like to call in. Line one, hello.
Hello, is this me?
Yes.
Mr. Bouton, I have nothing but high praise for your efforts to bring a simple game to the people. And I thoroughly enjoyed the observation that you made about democratizing the ownership of the team to the people. And the example of the Green Bay Packers, who are so wildly successful.
Yes.
My question would be then, without being evil, I'll say, could you and your partner bring this, I hope you maybe have an ambition here to try and rescue other minor league teams or whatever, maybe the Montreal Expos, if they still exist.
Do we want to take our act on the road?
I'm sure your wife would hate to meet me.
Yeah. we won't be coming to a theater near you. But I am going around the country speaking at universities, to their journalism schools and their public policy courses, urban studies programs, that kind of thing. And in the process, I hope to, make the points here. But I can't get involved in a grassroots campaign in town. That's up to the citizens, who have to gather themselves and insist on democracy in their town.
What I would like to know is, did you and your partner, in the process of trying to sell shares or propose to sell shares so that the city would own the team, for so many other people with baseball teams in their hometowns that are, under 20,000 and the like, that love their teams, can you play the same way that the corporations are playing and simply take ownership public and put it on the NASDAQ or something like that and get around, and anyone who can buy shares, and then you just have help these poor people by setting up parameters of saying no one owner can have more than 15-20 shares of stock in our corporation?
Well, it would take
a manhandle that away and play by their rules, but play them as hardball as these jokers do.
It would take a local ownership group who wanted to do that, who was willing to share the ownership of the team that they bought with local fans. And most local ownership groups don't want to do that. Most businessmen are in it for themselves, and they're not in it for the community. And so they want a team that they can move around. It's a much more valuable asset when they can move from town to town, because then they can bid one community off against another. So you really need to find some very, very civic-minded businessmen who are willing to do this. It's not an easy thing.
I think we have a situation right now with a minor league ice hockey team in Danville. And I've just come into the conversation a little bit ago, but I think this very same coup is trying to be affected with the Danville hockey team in trying to find a bigger venue and strip the city of Danville of their team. And I bet they would love, the people in Danville would love to hear what you have to say and discover some of the great tools necessary for trying to keep them where they are loved.
Yeah. Relentlessness is the tool that you need more than anything, I've discovered. And even then, you know, it doesn't guarantee success, but it's an important exercise, this notion of the people deciding, what they get in the way of public policy. And too bad that the politicians are much more beholden to corporate interests now than they are to voters themselves. They can always buy the voters off with, you know, advertising that they can put out and with the money they get from corporations. So we don't really have politicians representing the people anymore. That's the problem. When Mayor Giuliani of New York was asked why the citizens of New York City should not be allowed to vote on whether or not new minor league baseball stadiums are built for the Mets and Yankees, and Giuliani said, yeah, because they would vote against it.
Geez, the will of the people being served by their decisions.
Right.
I like it. What do they call that?
Right.
Democracy?
Yeah.
That's cool. Sign me up.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing everything you have to say for the rest of the hour.
All right. Well, we appreciate the comment. And I guess maybe we just should be clear that that the reason that you became interested in this particular ballpark and trying to save at the park there in Pittsfield is because you live in the area and this was kind of your neighborhood team, right?
Yeah, this was the local team, and Wacona Park is it's such a beloved place, and we just hated to see it get abandoned, and a new team forced down the people's throats, and so that's why we got involved. But that's what a community needs. It needs to have people come forward who care enough about it and are willing to make a fight over it.
Hmm. Let's talk with somebody else in one of the neighboring communities here, Philo, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Mr. Mountain, I'm more than mildly curious as to whether the Berkshire Eagle ever reviewed foul ball, and if so, who wrote the review and what did it say?
No, of course not. The Berkshire Eagle hasn't reviewed foul ball, even though it's been reviewed by other papers around the country. And I haven't been a guest on radio stations in Pittsfield. It's like as if there was a cone of silence over the area here, and they don't print our letters to the editor either. So it's not a proud story. It used to be a wonderful newspaper years ago when it was locally owned, but since it's been taken over by Media News Group, whose boss. Whose owner is in Denver, Colorado, and that's when I decided to take notes. You know, I went into this project not with the idea of writing a book, but just simply saving this old ballpark. And when one of the city council members told my partner and I that the city council couldn't consider our proposal until they were released by Andy Mick. Now, Andy Mick is the publisher and president of the local newspaper. So we went to Andy Mick and we said, Andy, what about our proposal here? Why not, take a look at this and, this is important for the community. And he said, it's not up to me, it's up to my boss in Denver, Colorado. So here, I said to myself, gee, Pittsfield's, almost 100-year legacy of baseball in this community is now in the hands of a guy in Denver. That's when I started taking notes.
Where do things stand now? What's happened since the publication of your book?
Well, you'd be very interested to know that a recent development is that the old mayor has been swept out of office, so have the city council, so have the parks commissioners, and the new mayor, Jimmy Roberto, has just invited my partner and I to come back to Pittsfield and bring our proposal back to the city of Pittsfield, and we are now in the process of negotiating a license agreement for the old stadium that would allow us to go in there and renovate the park and at the same time buy a team in a local independent league, the idea of selling stock to the people. So we have been invited back, and my partner is calling foul ball. He said it's the book that changed the city because it so graphically showed what needed to be done and who the bad guys are. And the city seems to be, at least on this issue, now in the process of transforming itself.
Well, congratulations. As one with a family in Pittsfield from long standing, I'm very pleased to see something progressive going on there.
Yeah, we are too. It's a wonderful, almost amazing, unbelievable development, the reception that we are now getting from the new Parks commissioners.
Well, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Right, thanks for the call. And I guess I also read that the newspaper find somebody to sell their land to. Is it still the plan that a pharmacy is going to be built on that site?
Yeah, they finally put a CVS pharmacy on that property. But it's interesting, even though the mayor has invited us back and welcomed us back, and we're now coming back because we just like the warm welcome we're receiving from the government. The newspaper is still sniping at us, so that'll be a part of the fun. But as my partner Chip said, as soon as we lose those guys as our opponents, it won't be as much fun anymore.
Yeah. Was there one of the things that you write about it in the book and part of the story is the concerns about the possibility that there were environmental contaminants at this site, the one where the pharmacy is now? Was it ever really? Do you feel that it was conclusively established just what the environmental situation was about that spot?
Yes. Well, there are two pieces of property involved, both of them owned by the newspaper. One, which is where they is the land immediately around the newspaper, and the other parcel was an adjacent piece that they bought to complete the larger footprint for the stadium, which would have been overlapping both the new parcel that they bought plus the existing land. But the environmental report on the parcel that they bought was that it was polluted. This was discovered by an environmentalist friend of mine at the DEP in Massachusetts, and the document that proved that was polluted was revealed, that was made public for the first time on page 360 of my book. Before that, there was no public information or no public notice by the newspaper that this was polluted property. There was also a clause in the Civic Authority. This is the group that would have bought and would have managed and built the new stadium. There was a clause in there that said that if pollution is found on the property, it would pass. The responsibility for the cleanup would pass on to the citizens, and the newspaper would be absolved of the cleanup. So it was conclusively proven that pollution was on, at least on the new parcel, and most likely on the larger parcel since they're contiguous. Nobody can find the results of the test borings that have been done on that property years ago for some reason. They can't be found.
Yeah, and I guess for their part, the company that owns the paper, and the most recent story I came across on this, I think, was one from a couple months ago from the New York Daily News, where they actually quote the guy who was the CEO of the company that owns that paper, the Eagle. It's the seventh largest newspaper chain. Basically, he says that he doesn't think that's true, that the pollution problem, if there ever was one, was cleaned up, and that there's nothing wrong with this site.
Well, they spent a lot of money cleaning it up for CVS before they would be willing to take it. So it has been proven conclusively that it's polluted, And it's pretty clear that the newspaper was negligent in informing its readers about this information.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Maybe I should just introduce again our guest real quick. We're talking with Jim Boughton. You may know him for his book, Ball Four. It was first published in 1970. It came out in a 30-year anniversary edition in 2000 with a new epilogue published by himself, and it's Bulldog Publishing is the name of the publisher. So if you've never read Ball 4, you might want to take a look at that. And then the book that tells the story that we're talking about here this morning, his efforts to try to save this ballpark, the oldest minor league ballpark in the United States, Wacona Park in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He tells that in the book Foul Ball, My Life and Hard Times Trying to Save an Old Ballpark. Same publisher there. It's Bulldog. He's going to be talking about this whole story tomorrow afternoon on the U of I campus. He'll be speaking in the Plym Auditorium at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, sponsored by the Departments of Urban Planning, Architecture, Landscape Architecture, Leisure Studies. So the talk is at 4. There'll be a book sale and signing at 5. And then also there'll be he'll be at the Borders in Champaign tomorrow night at 7 for another signing. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, and if you'd like to meet him and pick up a copy of the book and get it signed, you can do that. Here on the program, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We have somebody next up in Effingham, line number 4.
Right, Mr. Boughton, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I read Ball 4 when I was a teenager. I kind of had to hide it in the drawer from my mother, but it was the best baseball book ever written.
Thank you.
I got a couple questions. Did you know a pitcher by the name of Roger Alexander?
Sure. I was roommates with Roger Alexander when I was making my comeback with the Atlanta Braves in 1978.
He's a cousin of mine. He lives in Texas now, just to let you know.
Uh-huh. Yes, I know he does. We keep in touch once in a while.
That's great. I've got one other question. What's your feeling on a former owner of the Texas Rangers who got the taxpayers to build a new stadium and turned his $600,000 investment into $14 million?
Yeah, fellow's name is George Bush. He's now the president of the United States, and that's really how he made his fortune, was this investment in the Texas Rangers, invested $600,000, and then used his influence with his dad in politics to get a new baseball stadium built for the Texas Rangers. Now, once a team has a new stadium to play in, it increases the value of that team tremendously because they're able to make more money at the stadium. And so George Bush's contribution went from $600,000 to $14 million. Incidentally, he bought a small percentage of the team, but when they gave him his payout, they voted him an extra bonus for, quote, services rendered, without mentioning what those services were.
Future governor of Texas, perhaps.
Yeah, but that exactly. But that just shows you how money is made by these team owners. As Bill Veeck once said, you don't make money running a team. You make money buying and selling them. And that's why you have such a big turnover with these sports teams. Also, there are tax advantages to owning a team. Like, for example, you can accelerate the depreciation of the players' salaries as if they were machines, and then the new owner can start from scratch again with the salary. So, you know, when wealthy people don't pay their taxes, and when wealthy people get taxpayers to build them stadiums, that means everybody else has to make up the difference. So, people who aren't even baseball fans, who aren't even sports fans, are indirectly subsidizing owners' profits and players' salaries.
Does that get at your question?
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Okay, well, we'll go on here and talk with somebody in Indiana next. Line number 1. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it was a wooden structure, and that takes me back to my days in high school when some of the cities here in Indiana had rather, at that time, elaborate wooden structures for their stadiums for high school teams. Is there any interest in using the sense of people coming to look at something like that, like they do now with, say, the wooden roller coasters, sort of taking on a life of their own? I was wondering if that Pittsfield stadium could, present itself as a tourist attraction for that town, too.
That's exactly what our plan was, and it looks like we may be able to make that come true. To turn it into a living museum, which is actually still hosting baseball, professional baseball, and yet at the same time it's an historic experience. And that's precisely what we want to do. We've applied for historic register status so that Pittsfield and Wacona Park can become a destination for people who are interested in preservation, interested in history, interested in early architecture, that kind of thing.
Well, thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, wherever you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455, and then locally, 333-9455. And the next caller here is in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi, this is quite an honor. I read Balfour, too, but I didn't have to hide it. Anyway, I was wondering, what do you think will be the future of say, like Fenway Park and some of the really old stadiums, Yankee Stadium?
Well, Fenway Park right now appears to have reasonably enlightened owners who have decided that that they can do pretty well by, restoring or by keeping it restored and keeping it as an active park, but there's always the threat that that they're going to insist on a new stadium in another part of town. So that's always sitting there. In New York, Mayor Giuliani's last act before he left as mayor was to put on the drawing boards two new stadiums in New York City, one for the Mets and one for the Yankees, at a total cost, a combined cost of $1.6 billion. The new Yankee Stadium was either proposed for the west side of Manhattan or, believe it or not, directly across the street from the existing Yankee Stadium, which would then be torn down and made into a parking garage. And I wonder if the parking garage would be called the garage that Ruth built. But that just shows you the absurdity of this whole thing. This historic Yankee Stadium, which has already been renovated once in the 1970s, and not done well, by the way. They did not preserve a lot of the architectural features that they should have that was characteristic of the original Yankee Stadium. But the thought of tearing that down, because they're only drawing 3.2 million people a year, to build another stadium next to it, which might draw 3.4 million, it just shows you the level of absurdity that we've arrived at here.
Have you been following I guess it was recently settled, but the controversy with the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field and the rooftop owners?
Yeah, I sort of been following that indirectly, but there's always there are always the people who want to preserve these stadiums, and they're always grassroots organization. You never hear anybody in town with a door-to-door campaign to build a new stadium, or that always comes from the top. The people who want to save the stadiums are the people who actually live in the community.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call. Again, we have about 15 minutes left. We have folks listening and want to call in, ask questions, make comments. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something that you mentioned almost in passing in the book, and many of the reviewers have commented on, is the role in which personal tragedy plays, perhaps, for you in your interest in trying to save the park. And it has to do with a loss that you experienced, losing a child who was killed in an accident. Is that something that now, as you think about it, you realize was part of, just maybe part, of what interested you in trying to save Wacona Park?
Somebody pointed that out to me, and I didn't. I haven't given it too much thought. I do know that it was helpful to have a project that I could throw myself into completely, and maybe that's part of why I have pursued this so strenuously, because on some level it was therapeutic for me. Who knows, how the mind works. what the body tries to, how the body tries to, you know, fix itself, cure itself. Mm. But I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't a connection between the two.
I came across an interview that you did where you were talking about the story of foul ball and the effort to save the park and different things about baseball. I was interested at one point you were talking about how this issue of how, I guess, when ball players, former ball players get together, they like to talk about how, well, you know, in our day, we really know how to do it. And these kids today, you know, they're not quite. and you were having this conversation with somebody who had played, I guess, at the time that you did. And you said to him, now, look, when we were playing, we would hear the old guys say that, and we would say they were nuts. And so now here we are saying the same thing. And you apparently were saying that, in fact, you thought that today the players of today, because of their training, because they're bigger, because they're stronger, they actually are better players. Or is that more? Is it more to do with the fact that the nature of the game has changed, and so now it's real important to be able to knock them out of the park as many as you possibly can. And when you played, it wasn't quite so much like that.
I think both things are true. I think players today generally, and you know, putting the steroids aside, which adds a whole other evil dimension to the game, I think players generally, without the steroids, are just, they're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger, and athletes have gotten better in all the sports over the years. It's just... You know, you have better coaching, you have better training, you have video cameras. Players can correct the mistakes in their pitching motion and their batting motions, and correct it the next time at bat. They just go into the clubhouse, they watch themselves on the TV, they do replays. We didn't have any of that. We had no idea what we looked like when we were pitching or hitting. There was no video. So things are more sophisticated today. Players have better training along the way. And also we're drawing from a much wider audience. Baseball talent is now coming not just from America, but from Asia and Latin America. And so it's a wider population to draw from. The players are better athletes. They're bigger and stronger, but they don't, the nature of the game has changed with a slightly smaller ballparks, and I don't know, maybe they've even juiced up the baseball, but the emphasis on the home run, to me, has destroyed the subtle beauty of the game. So you don't need the skills. You know, in an 18-10 game, you don't need somebody who can steal a base or bunt or hit and run or hit the cutoff man, doing the little things that I always thought were beautiful about baseball. So it's a grosser game now. It's, you know, bigger actions and bigger movements, and I think it's more boring, actually. To me, the home run is about as boring now as the dunk in basketball. It's so ubiquitous, it has lost its excitement.
Got somebody here on a cell phone. I want to get to them. Line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I heard you mention about building a stadium across the street from another stadium and becoming a parking lot. Are you familiar with the Chicago Stadium going down, which was not a baseball stadium, but where they played basketball and hockey? And do you find in a lot of these things that go down, they lose a bunch of history?
Oh, yeah. That's why the people want, the fans generally want to keep the old ballpark, even though it may be a little bit more uncomfortable and it doesn't have the amenities of the new ballpark, because they go to the ball games because it's part of their family tradition. They know who their father's favorite team was, their grandfather's team. They took them to these stadiums, and baseball, for many families around the country, have become a religion of sorts, and the stadiums are the churches, they're the temples, and the thought of tearing down a church or a temple to build a more modern one is just be unthinkable in any other endeavor. But here in sports, that's what they do because the baseball owners are calling the shots.
There at the Chicago Stadium, one of the pieces of history that was lost was one of the largest theater organs ever constructed.
Sure,
and it was lost.
So we're losing our history, and it's a sad thing, and it's scary, particularly for older people, to see these kinds of physical changes and losing pieces of our history. Because I think, on some level, the thought is, you know, if they can tear down these old structures and sort of let them go, then who's going to remember us?
Yeah, that's true. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We're coming down to having about 7-8 minutes. I'm reminded that I said way back at the beginning of the program that I would have you tell the story of how it is that you came to publish this book yourself, Foul Ball, and I better do that before we end up out of time, as you did have a contract with a publisher to do this book, right?
Yeah, the publisher was Public Affairs. They were excited by the book. It was going to be the lead book in their catalog, and a month before they were ready to print this catalog, the president of the publishing company sat down with me and told me that I would need to get balancing comments from General Electric for what I was saying about them in my book. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I didn't get balancing comments from Major League Baseball, and I wrote Ball 4. I'm not going to do it with Foul Ball. Then he tells me in the next breath that the top lawyer for General Electric is a friend of his, and he's going to become a partner in Public Affairs. A few days after that, the editor with whom I'd been working on the book tells me I have to remove all references to General Electric and pollution or they're not going to publish the book. And I said, well, forget about that. I'm going to publish this book. And then they wouldn't give me a termination letter, which is what I needed in order to go to a different publisher. Months went by. I had to hire a lawyer to get this letter, finally. During the course of trying to get my termination letter, the lawyer for Public Affairs told my agent that I could keep half of my advance if I promised not to say why I was leaving Public Affairs. I told my agent, I said, I don't know what my price for silence is, but I know it's not $25,000. Finally, by the time I got free of this publishing company, nobody could publish it in a timely manner. I wanted it out in June of last year, and so I had to publish the book myself. It's a sad story about publishing.
Hmm.
The same sort of concentration in the publishing industry affects the creative product as the concentration in the media industry.
Yeah. Just I'm now that we did that, I want to make sure we did that because someone, I think, called in and said, hey, you said you were going to ask him to talk about that, and you didn't. Just to go back to talk about baseball a little bit and this issue of now – as you said, there's so much emphasis placed on hitting home runs, and so that the players are bigger and stronger. They spend time doing strength training that they probably didn't used to. But there's also this concern that some of that muscle is chemically developed, and people are really concerned that baseball is simply not dealing with this. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, they haven't dealt with it, and they should have dealt with it a long time ago. When I wrote in 1970 about players taking pep pills, the baseball owners tried to pretend that didn't happen and that it was an exaggeration, and they didn't really do anything about it. And now, because they've turned their back on this problem, it's escalated, and it's even worse than it was back then, because these steroids are very dangerous. And even the Players Association has been on the wrong side of this issue. They've been elevating player privacy rights foolishly over the health rights of the players, and also the competitive environment. You can't have players who are not taking steroids having to compete for jobs with players who are taking steroids. So for those reasons, the Players Association should have really come out very strongly against steroids, and that wasn't done, and now they're paying the price for it because all of those records and all the recent home runs are now called into question.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really tears at the fabric of baseball because it's the fans' interest in comparing modern players with the older players that keeps that generational thing going. And without that, I mean, if there's a whole section of records that are now suspect, it really turns people away. And I think it's a bigger problem for baseball than gambling,
yeah,
than Pete Rose's gambling.
No, I think people probably would now, because people are in public life seem to be willing just about say just about anything and talk about what they do. I think people have forgotten just what a flap a Ball 4 caused when the book was published. And this really was the first real wide open tell it like it is, I think, sports memoir that anybody had ever written. And I guess it's a indication of just how people reacted to it that after that you wrote a sequel that you titled I'm Glad You Didn't Take It Personally. I guess a lot of people did. Do you still run into people who have strong reactions to the kind of things that you wrote about in now more than 30 years ago when you wrote Ball 4?
No, No, people come up to me now. They've read Ball Four, and they say, "Boy, you know, it's a funny book, but it's I don't understand what the controversy is all about. It's so tame by today's standards." The big controversy in Ball Four, by the way, for people who may not have read the book, is I said Mickey Mantle hit a home run with a hangover, and that was the big deal at that time. Baseball would certainly like to have its problems be reduced to an occasional hangover. They got bigger problems right now. But let me tell you one more thing, as long as we're on the subject of my observations here. One of the things that bothers me more than anything is this A-Rod going to the Yankees. And to me, it should be questioned by sports writers. I mean, here's a guy who's being celebrated for the fact that he's going to finally get a World Series ring. Not earn one, mind you, but get one. He signed a contract to play for the Texas Rangers with the idea that they were not a good team. He understood that, and he was going to help try and make them better. Well, he went down there for a few years, but he tried to make them better. He wasn't able to do that, but then he quit. He quit trying to make the Texas Rangers better, and he gave a very short list of teams he would be willing to play for now. The Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. Why? Well, because they were going to be in the playoffs, and he wanted to be in the playoffs, too, so he could get a World Series ring. So we have not only a quitter, but a front runner. And it's really a disturbing thing, and he's not being called on the carpet about this. It's perfectly all right, evidently, in sports, that a player who's a good player should be entitled to get a ring. What kind of a message does this send to kids? Reminds me when I was young and the players went down to the field to form up. There was a new league starting in town, and the best players on the team all tried to jump on the same line of, you know, we were forming lines of 20 kids each, and they all tried to jump on the same team so that they could have the best team. There was no thought let's make this team better, or let's get some balance here, or let's have something that's really a contest. You know, I hated those kids who had to be on a winning team. It's like, remember we used to go down the field and, you know, nine kids would show up, so you'd play five against four, and everybody wanted to be on the team with five so they could win the game. I always wanted to be on the team with four. I'd rather lose tough with four than win easy with five. So the whole notion of whether sports is about competition or whether sports is getting handed a trophy for being on the winning team.
Well, we've used up our time. For people here in Champaign-Urbana, again, our guest Jim Bouton will be talking about his experiences trying to save this ballpark. We've talked about it. It's the topic of his book, Foul Ball. He'll be on the campus tomorrow afternoon. He'll be speaking in the Plame Auditorium 4 in the afternoon. After that, there'll be a signing, and there'll also be a book signing at the Champaign Borders bookstore tomorrow night at 7. And Mr. Bouton, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David. My pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from Reap Farms of Melvin, Illinois, representing Pioneer Hybrid International Seed Products. The broadcast also made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from Russia, South America, Mexico, and Britain, and featuring food tastings every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest